Victoria Adams, who's a research assistant at the Center for Sexuality and Health Disparities at the University of Michigan School of Public Health.
Hi, I'm Victoria. I'm from Michigan, the Center for Sexuality and Health Disparities, and I'm going to be talking to you about some barriers that trans men who have sex with men experience when they're accessing healthcare. I have no conflicts of interest to disclose or report. Okay, so I'm going to start with just a glossary of terms and then go into a little bit of the background that already exists in terms of literature and research on this population. Then I'm going to talk about the study design and our participants and some of the barriers that they identified and the tactics that they had for navigating those barriers. And I'm going to finish talking about their suggestions and then our recommendations based on their suggestions and other research within the interviews. Okay, so I'm just going to do a really quick glossary. I know we're all coming from different places and may have different definitions of words or understanding of them. So this is, when I refer to these terms, this is how I'm going to be defining them. A trans man, female to male or FTM, and transsexual male is a person assigned female at birth who currently identifies their gender as a man or masculine. Cisgender is a person whose gender identity is aligned with the sex they were assigned at birth. And I'll also be using cis woman or cis man to describe the gender of the cisgender person. A trans man who has sex with men, or a TMSM, is a transmasculine individual who has sex with cisgender and or trans men. And some of the gender affirmation procedures I'll be talking about are hormone replacement therapy and TOP surgery. Gender affirmation procedures are medical procedures that help trans individuals to match their bodies to the gender identity that they identify. And for trans men, hormone replacement therapy usually takes the form of testosterone or T injections, and this helps to develop secondary sex characteristics. And TOP surgery is a bilateral mastectomy along with chest recontouring in order to masculinize their upper torso areas. Okay, so some of the background of the previous literature on trans men who have sex with men found that there are they face enormous barriers to accessing healthcare, and that it's difficult to locate services that account for both their gender identity and their sexuality. And while there is a lot of research around the sexual health needs of trans men and trans men who have sex with men, there's a deficit of information on how this population accesses general health care. And all research on trans individuals, and especially around trans men who have sex with men, stress the importance of cultural competency and the acknowledgement of multiple identities. So with that background, we designed the Ungender study in 2012, and this study had 15 in-depth semi-structured interviews with TMSM in the San Francisco Bay Area. And they had a lot of variation within their ages, between 20 and 48, with an average of about 30. And the racial makeup was 60% white, about 30% mixed race, and 13% Latino. And I mentioned the race because while the sample was predominantly white, there are many other barriers that relate to the race of the individuals. And so while I'm talking about predominantly white trans men who have sex with men and the barriers they encounter, just I guess think about how this would be even more so within populations of color. And all of our participants identified as gay, queer, or bisexual. And all had undergone some kind of medical affirmation procedure, whether that was T or TOP surgery or some combination of the two. So our interviews lasted between 80 and 285 minutes, on average about 135. And they were later transcribed and coded for relevant themes. And then researchers reconciled the codes prior to analysis to make sure there was agreement. And so from this analysis, we came up with three questions that we found interesting or intriguing and wanted to explore further. That was what the barriers are faced by trans men who have sex with men when they're seeking health care, how the individuals within the population overcome the barriers, and if there's consistency in how they overcome the barriers, and what suggestions this population has for healthcare providers to improve their healthcare. So the first grouping of respondent answers around barriers to healthcare was around access. Some of the services that were hailed as the most supportive or affirming also had limited funding. And because of this, there were fewer avenues for low-income individuals to access the centers or the practitioners. It was also difficult for participants to secure appointments at these centers as they were understaffed and had a lower capacity. Though clinics that specialized in women's health were the most accessible to participants, the attention participants received for being the only men in the waiting room kept many from returning to the centers and the clinics. Participants faced issues relating to healthcare coverage if their legal IDs did not match their current gender. And thus, even when a participant was able to locate appropriate services that were relevant to their needs, they weren't always able to utilize them. And one of our participants, Chuck, gave an example of an access barrier that he encountered, saying, quote, "I'm in the system as male, so I might be getting a card. Oh, it's time for them. What's that called? Prostate, you know, check. And, you know, my male to female friend is getting something that says it's time for her, you know, whatever, pap smear. And neither one of us is getting good health care." Another grouping of the respondent answers around barriers to healthcare was in exclusion. Zachary gave an example of how this impacted him when he originally moved to the Bay Area, saying, quote, "I think a lot of people don't seek services because they don't see it anywhere. They don't see it being advertised. But you always see those cards that say, if you're a trans woman, we have these services, you know. I kind of thought at first that there were no services, and so I kind of was like, what do I do?" While the Bay Area does have medical resources that serve the studied population, participants experienced difficulty locating them due to a lack of inclusion in advertised service and specialties. Of the providers who did prove to have cultural competency regarding trans men who have sex with men, few of them marketed themselves as being trans knowledgeable or experienced in gay men's health issues. Some of the centers excluded trans individuals from research-based services, and this was especially common in trans men. Additionally, services that are marketed as being trans competent were found to be focused on the health of trans women, especially around HIV services. Another barrier that participants identified was around knowledge and information of themselves and their providers. And Ron gave an example of something he would have to say to all of his general healthcare practitioners when he first met with them, saying, quote, When you run my lab tests, you will be looking, I have to explain my cholesterol, my bone density, all these things, right? Used to be female, and now they're living in a body that is being pumped full of testosterone every single week for 7 years. So my body is physiologically changed and developed as a male body on top of a female sex body. So when participants were able to locate resources for either trans individuals or gay, bisexual, and queer men, they often reported being disappointed with the services that they encountered. Most healthcare practitioners did not have the knowledge or baseline information for evaluating health for individuals who had medically transitioned. And many of the participants reported not knowing enough information to advocate for themselves in these situations, or felt too uninformed to ask questions. And the last barrier that our participants encountered was around cultural competency. Many providers made assumptions around participants' behavior and their risk factors. Others use inappropriate language when discussing participants' bodies or within their gender identity, mispronouncing them. And participants also noted additional barriers relating to disability, race, class, and education that were ignored by healthcare providers when seeking services. For this last point, Tucker, one of our participants, explained the difficulty within that, saying, quote, "So like, there was even, like, if a doctor is telling you to eat healthier because you're on hormones, it's like, okay, where do I go to eat healthier? Like, how do I do that? How do I buy groceries for that? Or, like, if I need help buying groceries and, like, my ID isn't changed, like, how do I do that without outing myself or, like, possibly putting myself in danger? Or how do I feed my kid?" Our participants did have several strategies that they utilized to work around these barriers in accessing health services. One common one was around self-advocacy. Ren, one of our participants, stated the need for this, saying, quote, "Transgender communities and individuals need to also educate themselves and learn to self-advocate, but it's especially hard when you're trying to assert your gender, first of all, and then assert what you need medically, even if you just have a cold." So people became advocates for themselves, keeping up to date on medical and legal information so they could provide guidance to doctors or hold their position if their rights were being violated. Learning about the health clinic and procedures before seeking services was also listed as beneficial to participants. They would research information relating to the procedures and rights, but this often came from internet sources, and as there isn't sort of a set internet source that has all the information required for the participants, a lot of time they got conflicting or incorrect information. And another method they used for working around the systems was within community support. And Leonard, another participant, gave an example of this that also included some aspects of self-care, saying, quote, I bring three people with me to the doctor. Like, if I'm bringing someone, I bring the person I'm dating. I made my best friend go with me before, and I make them talk to me. This is what I do, and then I treat myself to breakfast with mimosas. The importance of community was stressed in accessing healthcare. Some participants created a support system for visiting doctors so they would not be the only trans individual in the situation. Others utilized community resources that were already in place. Creating information networks to pass along information was also important to the men interviewed, and this was both in accessing those resources and then being a mentor, depending on where within the community the participant was. And while later I will talk about our specific recommendations, I wanted to take the time to mention what our individuals specifically recommended for practitioners. One was around community-driven care, and participants felt that community organizations should distribute information around health, safety, and healthcare resources more widely than it already is. Additionally, community-based organizations could serve as centers for those struggling with barriers to their healthcare, whether social or economic barriers. While there's great distrust for medical systems within trans populations, individuals who are already trusted advocates for sexuality and gender minorities in the area could educate and encourage critical consciousness interpersonally and within the healthcare systems. And Francisco, another one of our participants, had a specific suggestion for this, and he said, quote, I don't know if this exists, but sort of a trans buddy system where, like, there's a network where people list off, like, if they have any types of appointments that they want to or that they need to go to, where they might need some sort of support system to go there with them, either to just be kind of an advocate or just be there as peer support, or, you know, just to be there so they're not the only dude in an all-female space. Another suggestion that participants had was that the providers be better trained. And Ram, one of our participants, had a pretty detailed suggestion for what this would look like, saying, quote, provider training is a three-part thing. Do the research and gain your cultural competency and learn how to incorporate that into your practice because you're already good at, you know, practicing medicine or learning how to do a pap smear now. You just need to learn how to alter your language so as not to offend the man in your stirrup. Holding yourself out, which includes making sure that your front desk receptionist is competent to check in the nice man for his pap smear. And then having a support system. Those are the three. So suggestions for improving cultural competency were mentioned throughout the interviews. Making sure healthcare providers and staff were knowledgeable about trans and queer issues was important to some participants, while others thought that even knowing what language to use would make a difference in their experiences. Recommendations for achieving this range from mandatory trans-inclusive curriculums in medical school to the distribution of a brief by some larger institution on the appropriate ways to interact with gender nonconforming clients. And having appropriate services was also recommended by our participants. This would include changing the systems and requirements so they weren't defaulted on a certain sexuality or gender dichotomy. And this would help the hardships due to changing legal gender marker or one that reported an incorrect gender identity. Participants also stated that doctors and healthcare providers should ask more questions rather than making assumptions. And while parts of this did relate to gender identity, others were around sexual practices, food and nutrition accessibility, ability status, and work. So our recommendations that we developed for providers are based on these suggestions and also on other things that they said throughout the interviews. And we think most important is staying informed on issues, and this is within health issues and new research on this population or people who are undergoing gender affirmation procedures, but also on legal and social issues that are related to this population. and learning how to ask appropriate questions was important, and also deferring to patients if they didn't have an answer or if something that you feel about their body or their experiences is different to what they're telling you. And then while being informed about issues regarding this population is important, if that information is not or training is not available, to rely on the familiarity with your work instead of that. So one of our participants said, you already know how to catheterize a person with a vulva. And so taking any hang-ups or misinformation you may have about the gender of your patient out of the equation and just focusing on your work. And then a large one is utilizing community organizations, and that's also it's for your training and for the training of your staff members, but then also to get the word out about the services that you provide and the competency that you have. That's it. Thank you to our participants, the Sex Lab, for funding the project and providing professional and emotional support, and the other coders and transcribers. And that's my contact information if you have any questions. Thank you.